With your back to the green oasis of Regent's Park, you head east along the hustle and bustle of the A501.
Turn left.
The road is choked with buses, taxis and cyclists.
You've arrived at your destination.
The security guard at the entrance insists you place everything in a clear plastic bag. You're directed into a hushed room, somewhere I've spent hundreds of hours. At your fingertips are some of the rarest maps in the world. I'm Jerry Broughton, a map historian. Welcome to What's Your Map? An Oculi Mundi exploration. In this series, we speak to people who live, love, and work with maps, making, preserving, interpreting, and being inspired by them. In each episode, we ask our guests to unfold a map that is special to them and tell us the story behind it. To look at the map as we talk about it on this podcast, go to oculi-mundi.com. The British Library contains one of the greatest collections of maps, over 4.5 million and growing. The guest on today's What's Your Map was the head of this collection from 2001 to 2015 and worked for the library for 40 years. Peter Barber, welcome to What's Your Map. And in front of us is a map that you've brought us, an early 16th century map. Tell me about this map, Peter. What does it show us?
Well, it shows us all sorts of things. Most obviously, the geography of the world as it was perceived in about 1544. You'll see going from right to left, in other words, in Asia, you'll see Indonesia, what's now the islands of the Pacific. Africa looks recognisable, though there are one or two features which are copied from medieval cartography. For instance, the mountains of the moon, the origins of the
Nile.
Of the Nile.
Right in the centre there.
Absolutely.
And the Americas?
And the Americas are particularly interesting because North America is actually, at first glance, unrecognisable because it's so thin. South America is particularly interesting because it looks recognisable and it incorporates depictions from writers of the previous generation who described the cannibals and the giants of America. But we should pause there.
There's no title here. There's no date. Tell me who made the map. Where does it come from? What's significant about it for you?
Right. Well, this map is an illustration in a book that was published some 20 years earlier. But the map itself dates from 1544 and it's created by one of the greatest mathematicians and mapmakers, and indeed also physicians of the time, a Dutchman called Gemma Frisius, who was the subject of the Duke of Burgundy. Now, the Duke of Burgundy also happened to be the ruler of most of Europe and most of the world. He was Charles V.
And here he is.
Who's seen at the top?
This is Charles V. So Gemma Frisius is creating this map for Charles V.
Fifth, and it's not only flattery. If you look to the left of Charles V, you have a picture of Jupiter, the king of the gods, and the clear message is that Charles V, as Holy Roman Emperor of the German people, and the secular equivalent of the Pope, was the king of kings.
Yeah.
So the message comes through very clearly, but in fact, there's an even closer connection with Charles V, because this particular map, which incidentally is in the Sunderland collection and is digitised, can be seen by all, is a copy of a much larger map that Gemma Frisius created in 1540. Now, no example survives of this map, though we can continue searching for it. But before publishing it, Gemma Frisius actually sent it to the Emperor and asked for his opinion. And Charles V, who was interested in these matters, apparently made a few corrections.
Like, so, put me next to Jupiter.
Probably that. So you've got all sorts of things going on there.
But that's classic of this period, isn't it, Peter, from the mid-16th century, where you've got a printing tradition which is printing maps which are then changed and amended. So you have an original 1540, but then it's changed, and this is the 1544 version, and then there might even be a later version. I mean, this is part of the history of map printing and publication at this time.
It is, absolutely, and it sometimes happened, not always, that in the process the geographical content was played around with. Mm. Though I think in this particular case, probably it wasn't. And in fact, from written descriptions of the lost map, it looks pretty much as though this is indeed what it looked like.
So let's look at the detail here. Give me a sense of what's significant about this map. So we see these two Indias in the eastern right-hand corner, Africa and America, South America, looking vaguely correct, but you're also pointing out that there are some strange features here, the mountains of the Nile in Africa, there are representations of cannibals in the Americas. But what for you is so significant? Why is this a map that you've chosen here? What's important for you about it?
What's important to me is that it expresses so clearly the mentality of the time in a way which a written text wouldn't. Mm. But like most things, you have to really dig. At one superficial level, look around the edges and you see the winds. And if you look at the map itself, it has lines going across it. Well, we know from Gemma Frisius that the original map, and by implication this map too, was intended to be of use to sailors and enable them also to measure distances.
But nobody could use this to navigate, Peter, could
nobody they? Could use this to navigate, but the very fact that he claimed that it was on the cards tells you something about the mentality of the time, because exploration and the expansion of trade were two names for the same thing, and it made the rulers richer. One of the other really interesting things about the map is its shape. Though I have to say you needed a little bit of imagination, at the time people would have recognised that it sort of resembled a heart.
This is the so-called cordiform or heart-shaped projection.
Yeah. Now, this wasn't simply a mathematical formula, because when the map was made, Europe was fragmenting into religious camps, which were hostile to each other. War was always on the point of breaking out. There were zealots on both sides who wanted the war.
This is the Protestant Reformation and the moment at which the Catholics strike back.
In 1517, Luther had nailed a summary of his beliefs to a church door in Wittenberg, and in this declaration, he had attacked the papacy. And from that emerged the Protestant movement, which within a few years had been adopted by many German rulers, who then found themselves in conflict, not only with the Catholic rulers, but also with the Emperor, Charles V, who was regarded as, if you like, the secular equivalent of the Pope.
So then, Peter, how does Charles V deal with this protest, which is really what Luther represents? Protestantism comes from this Lutheran protest against the Catholic Church. What's his response?
Well, he was unnerved by it. And the simple answer is he just didn't know how to react. So his policy veered between extreme hostility, wars of religion in the middle of Germany, which were taking place at the time when this map was drawn, or an attempt at mediation. There's an attempt to sort of say, well, look, you know, you just rule your countries. Within your countries, you can do what you like, but so long as you're loyal to the overall structure, well, that's fine. And in a way, this map is an expression of the latter, that, you know, so long as you accept me as top dog, then what you do religious-wise in your own countries is up to you, even if, speaking personally, I don't really care for it.
And literally top dog, because he sits looking out over the world, so he's laying claim to the world. But we need to remember that this is a moment where Europe is on fire in terms of its sectarian conflict between Protestants and Catholics.
So, yeah.
They are at war with each other, and the map doesn't really, unless you can talk to somebody such as yourself, that gives us a sense of that. We can't really see that. It seems to be very, you know, beautiful and, you know.
except, as I say, we get back to this projection of the world like a heart, which certainly the more canny viewers of this map would have recognised as an appeal for moderation and...
Toleration.
Toleration, yeah.
Europe is on fire at this point, isn't it? Precisely in the 1540s, Lutheranism has taken hold, but it's ripped the continent apart, and there are perennial wars and conflicts.
And they get worse. In the next decade, there is a full-scale war. So what's that got to do with the map? What's that got to do with the heart? Well, contemporaries, unlike us, would immediately have recognised that the heart is a symbol of reconciliation and moderation. So however loyal Gemma Frisius was to Charles V, who was effectively the leader of the Catholic side, in the map, he's actually implicitly pleading for moderation and peace and tolerance. So this lifts them, this item, and perhaps this is the important thing for me, from being just geography to making a very important statement about human values, which continues to be valid to this day.
So it gives geography and maps a certain morality. There's a way in which maps can be connected to those kind of ideas. It's not about travelling from one place to another here.
No, and this is, I think, for me, it always has been one of the most interesting things about old maps. It's less the geography than the mentality. Every map, almost regardless, that was created, in fact, it's still the case now, but particularly with old maps, is an expression of the mentality. And it's for us to dig into it and to analyse it and to extract insights into the way that people thought.
And it might be, it's odd, isn't it? Because I agree completely with that. I mean, I've found in when I do my own research that it's really, you start with the map, but the map is not really about orientation or moving from one place to the other. It really is about reconstructing a certain mindset, a mentality, a philosophy from that period. And there's something about a map which gives you that insight, which perhaps other documents don't do.
The geography on the map is almost the latest knowledge of the world at the time. It's not absolutely up to date, but I think equally important are the remnants of the medieval belief about the nature of the world. And, you know, it's only too easy to be led astray on looking at this map by saying, gosh, gosh, we're in a new world, this is the Renaissance, you know, medieval superstition has been overthrown. It ain't like that at all.
So the Americas are interesting because we have a very odd representation of North America, which is labelled Bacalirum, and then you have a South America which shows and is labelled America and has Peru, but it also has these terms on it, cannibals and giants.
Yeah, exactly.
So what's happening there? What is this doing in terms of what geography thinks the world looks like in this early 16th century moment? What about North America? What about this description of it?
Well, I think North America is interesting in two particular ways. The obvious thing is the name, which stems from the fact that there were cod fisheries around. Well, Bacalarum is named after cod, and there were cod fisheries, as there still are, around Newfoundland, and you must remember that this is where John Cabot went. And if you want a saleable commodity, it was probably salted cod, since there wasn't much gold or anything like that in North America.
Fantastic. So it's a land of codfish. So it's only South America, as we know it, which is named America.
Yeah, but there's something much more interesting about North America, and that is, as you can see, that it's depicted as a narrow strip of land.
Mm-hmm.
And this is actually a relatively recent innovation. But this is a sort of example of wish fulfillment, because the Europeans genuinely thought, for various reasons, that North America was very thin and that therefore it would be very easy to get from there to the Pacific and to the wealth of the Far East. So it's not just a shape, it's also some dreams embodied in it.
And even in the top left-hand corner where we'd think the Pacific should be, it shows India and I think a version of Java. So it seems as though it's almost in completely the wrong hemisphere. But the idea there is that you can go west to get to what we would call the east.
Exactly. And I think this is what we mean about mentalities. This was the dream picture of the people who made the map because they really wanted to get to China. And in a way, the cod of North America was just a sort of added on and an irrelevance and something which you just passed by if you could. South America was a different kettle of fish because there they had found gold.
On the left-hand side, curving round the border of the map, are these climates. So, and it actually says Climata Australia.
Yeah.
So here we have this classical idea that there is already in the classical Greco-Roman tradition an idea of a place called Australia.
This is absolutely right. And there was also the idea of a place called Brazil.
So just explain that. That's a weird idea.
Well, the point is that most people, when they do pretty much everything, want confirmation of what they already believe. If something is as you thought it was, even if slightly different in form, then it's reassuring. If you get something that is genuinely new, it is disturbing, it is troubling. How do you cope with it? So there was a tendency on the part of 15th century explorers to name their new discoveries by names which were taken from classical knowledge, like the Fortunate Islands or the Canary Islands or Brazil or later Australia, though Australia simply means to the south.
So that's from the Latin meaning for the south.
Australis,
so
yeah.
Even Aristotle has this idea that if you have a temperate continent like Europe in the north, then there must be another one in the south, and that was therefore Australia.
Exactly.
So hundreds, even thousands of years before Australia comes into the European consciousness and is, in quotes, discovered, there is a concept there that can be then named so, right?
That is precisely it. And when you look at this map, you see a visualization of this mentality. So, I mean, it rams home again, you know. Most people today would look at this and say that it was a fairly modern map with a few primitive mistakes due to the lack of explanation or the credulity of the people who made it. Mm. But when you actually dig deeper, you actually get a very interesting spotlight on the mentalities circa 1540, which again, contrary to what you're told at school, which is there was the Middle Ages and then there was the Renaissance and the modern world, it represents a sort of mishmash between the two.
We should make the point that this is a what you would call a cosmology because it shows the cosmos. Because if we look at the what we'd call the traditional map showing America, Africa, Asia and Europe, it probably only takes up less than half of the actual sheet. And the rest of it are these images of, you know, classical gods and the emperor and the winds and clouds. So why is that, Peter? We'd look at that today and wouldn't think that's how a modern map should be. Why all this other stuff outside the boundaries of the world?
Well, first of all, people knew that the Earth was part of a larger cosmos, which arguably was more important. So it would be natural to include references to it. And in fact, on the right side of the map, you've got all of the symbols of the zodiac, which add an element of time to the depiction of space. And in that respect, even the depictions of these strange, you know, creatures, the cannibals and so on, emphasize the fact that maps at that time dealt with knowledge as a whole and not necessarily purely geographical knowledge.
So how is it made, Peter? Tell us about that.
The map is made on the basis, basically, of book learning. Gemma Frisius and Appian were both great mathematicians, great cartographers and so on, but they weren't the people who actually went on the boats. They were not the discoverers or the explorers. They were putting together their sources, evaluating them, coming up with a map which seemed to them to be accurate.
So they're armchair geographers.
They're armchair geographers, and they then hand over their sketches to engravers who create the map. And this particular map, I think, was created in the Netherlands because that's where Gemma Frisius was based.
And this is important, isn't it? Because we're still in the early years of printing. So you know, a previous generation, we were looking at mainly manuscript maps, but print has become a massive thing by this point in the early 16th century. And maps are at the forefront of that, I think. I mean, can you tell me a little bit about that? Because this is using woodcuts.
Printing at the time was done either as copperplate or as woodcut. The advantage of copperplate was that the lines were finer. But the disadvantage was that the plates wore out more quickly. With a wood block, you got rougher lines, but the wood block would last much, much longer. In a way, it's a reflection of the intentions of the maker that this is a wood block, that it is intended, as indeed proved to be the case, to come out in innumerable editions which stretched out for many, many decades later.
And exactly reproduced in woodblocks. But it is amazing to think that this, when you look at the image, has gone from, as it were, the scholar in his study through into a printing press and somebody has carved this out. I mean, that's quite extraordinary as you look at the detail of the map.
I think what is particularly important is that this map is made for the public. And I don't think one can emphasise this enough. This is made to be seen by the literate man in the street, which at that time was a relatively small number, but many, many more than would ever have seen a manuscript.
To do what, Peter? So give me a sense of that. How is this map being then sold and how are people receiving it? Are they reading it in their homes? Are they using it for trade? What are they doing?
I think they're using it in their homes. It's to give them information about the world. I don't think there's anything that is particularly geared to the merchant or to the politician, as would be the case with other maps.
Where does your love of maps stem from? As a child, were you fascinated by maps? Did this come later in life for you? What's the draw for maps?
I think there are two things. I certainly became aware of maps at an early age. But this was because my father was a GP, and in those days, GPs actually visited their patients in their homes. And in those days, and we're talking about the 1950s, it was considered fine to leave a 5-year-old or a 10-year-old in a car for about an hour. And the only thing I had to really entertain myself with was his A to Z.
Was the A to Z, which is, I had the same thing as a kid in a car in Bradford with my dad, who was a repossessions man, and I'd have the A to Z map. That's what we used.
Yep,
so it was the A to Z map that got you.
Well, and what particularly got me was that, for some reason, I found myself looking at the River Thames. And there were blank spaces along the River Thames, particularly in the east. And I had this fantasy. I mean, if a thing is black, it means that there are no buildings. If there are no buildings and it's by the river, it had to be sandy. If it was sandy, it had to be a beach. And I had this sort of fantasy of sort of these great beaches by the Thames where you could sun yourself. And even then, I was slightly puzzled at the fact that people weren't making more of it. Of course, it was only many, many years later that I discovered that actually these were munitions factories, which were being concealed.
Right, yeah. Blanks on the map.
Exactly.
So that's as a child. So where does that fascination with maps then go later in life? Is it purely a professional thing, or was it something that was more personal for you?
No, it's if you really want the honest truth,
yes.
I was employed by the British Library as an international historian, as a diplomatic historian, and I spent the first years of my career helping to catalogue the papers of the Duke of Marlborough, which had a few maps, but so what? But I was told very firmly by my then boss, the keeper of manuscripts, that diplomatic material wasn't important enough to justify a promotion. And I found myself in a position where I was a sole breadwinner and I'd just become a father, and there was no real means of supporting it. So I was desperate for promotion. And one day I was walking past the keeper's office when I heard him rowing with the man who was responsible for maps and music in the Department of Manuscripts. And he wanted to give up maps. And I was hauled in and asked whether I would take over maps. And I thought, promotion.
Pay rise.
Pay rise. And I said, I could, only for the keeper to say. Of course, there'll be no promotion in it. That was the end of it. And then I got really cold feet because I'd quite enjoyed maps. And in fact, I've recently discovered that I was getting prizes in school for drawing maps, which I'd completely forgotten about.
You see, you can't get away from
you
the maps.
You can't get away. But in any case, be that as it may, I really had cold feet because I'm not a geographer, I'm not a mathematician, I'm not interested in measurement.
Neither am I, we should say. Most people interested in maps are not mathematicians, exactly. Or even geographers.
No, but but this is the whole point. At that time, we're talking now about 1980 or so, maps had been part of the geography curriculum in universities. And that was not my world at all. And I phoned up the then head of the map library, Helen Wallace, and says, I think I've made the most awful mistake. Should I just say no? And she said, no, you can make of maps what you like.
It's an extraordinary statement by the head of maps.
You know, and she was absolutely right, because it just so happened that at that time, historians, literary figures and so on were getting interested in maps for things other than the technical measurement angle.
Because it is strange, isn't it, Peter, that there is no discipline for maps, and yet people are so fascinated by maps. But even in geography departments, if you go to university, you don't necessarily have to study maps. It's It's a strange, dissident world that we inhabit, isn't it? I mean, I'm not trained as a geographer either. You're not. Many of the people that we know in our world aren't geographers and certainly not scientifically trained. That seems odd, doesn't it? Because most people associate maps with mathematical precision, with navigation. Mm. But historically, that's not the case, is it?
A, it's not the case, but B, I think it's what makes the subject such a good one. Because, and here I think you might perhaps agree, if you're in a mainstream discipline like literature or history, it's a bit like a viper's nest. Everybody is competing for posts and promotion and so on, and nobody will privately say a good word for anybody else in the field. The history of maps is such a small field, and it's such a diverse field with people coming from all sorts of different angles, that it's actually, amazingly, a very friendly field.
We are a friendly bunch.
We are a friendly bunch, and at the end of the day, perhaps that's what counts.
Peter Barber, thank you very much for joining us on What's Your Map? Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to What's Your Map? I'm Jerry Broughton, map historian, and this has been an Oculi Mundi exploration. Oculi Mundi is the online home of the Sunderland collection of antique maps and atlases.